Okay. I'm going to give that another try. Let's see if we can get the recording for the second half of the lecture anyway. Let's give it a go. Okay. So I got to the stage where I've told you what Sharpe did. He pulled the usual neoclassical Swifty of aggregating individuals by assuming they're all the same. And this is how he justifies that Swifty. And it's a rather convoluted appeal to a very bad piece of methodology. I'll take you through it. So in order to derive conditions for equilibrium, we invoke two assumptions. First, we assume a common rate of interest, with all investors able to borrow or lend at the same rate. Second, now I love how he puts this, we assume homogeneity of investor expectations. That sounds better than saying we think you're all identical, doesn't it? We assume you have homogenous expectations. That sounds really cool. I'd like to be homogenous. It's a silly use of language. Funnily enough, Sharpe actually thanks. I wouldn't actually, but it's a nice line. Sharpe actually thanks a reviewer for suggesting this word to him. A better way of putting across the absolutely ludicrous idea of assuming that all investors are the same. And here he specifies it. They're assumed to agree on all the various aspects of an investment. Expected values, standard deviations, and correlation coefficients. In which case, there'd never be a dinner party conversation ever about shares, which actually wouldn't be a bad thing in some ways, because it totally denies what happens in the real world where you all disagree. Now, he says, of course, these are highly restrictive and undoubtedly unrealistic assumptions. So he knows he's made an absurd assumption. He justifies it by saying the Tropper test of a theory is not the realism of its assumptions, but notice what he says next, the acceptability of its implications. Or even that's a waffle. He's actually referring to Milton Friedman's work called the Methodology of Positive Economics. And what he says there, and it's not the acceptability of implications, is how well the theory fits the data, which is at least a reasonable idea, that a theory should fit the data. What Sharpe says instead is, this theory fits the theory. He says is these assumptions imply equilibrium conditions which form a major part of conventional financial doctrine. So he's justifying this crazy assumption on the basis that it fits the theory. That's not anything like the realism that Milton Friedman wanted, even though Milton was fairly unrealistic. So he said we have to use it even though it's absurd. Now, if you want to take a look at what Friedman actually said, then that hyperlink there goes through to my lecture on Friedman's methodology. But to me, what's actually happened here is yet another example of proof by contradiction being mistaken as a way of building a theory. Because an essential part of it is saying, here's, we build a theory of individual investor behaviour. How do we build a theory of aggregate investor behaviour? We have to assume there's one investor, which says you can't build a theory of aggregate investors on this basis. If you have to assume that all investors are the same to get the capital asset market line, then there is no capital market line. It's proof by contradiction, the theory doesn't work. Now, it could have been what's called a heuristic assumption. Again, I go through this in the methodology lectures. And that is an idea where you choose something which is obviously wrong, but then you develop it and say, let's now relax it and see what we get. Now, instead, that was never done by Sharpe. He never relaxed the assumptions. It's a counterfactual assumption. It says we assume about every last, we agree about every last stock, and we have the limitless ability to borrow at a risk-free rate. And this is the part that isn't said specifically by Sharpe in this paper, but it's pointed out later by his colleagues when they point out why the theory failed. It also has to be the case that those expectations about the future are correct. Because at no stage does the theory say, let's take the situation where expectations are wrong. Now, you could actually perhaps make a model where you say these expectations are all the same, but they happen to be wrong. That wasn't done. He's actually assuming that investors can predict the future. Not just that we all agree with each other, but we're also correct about what the future is going to be like. And that's the basis of the theory of finance you've been taught. Now, given that absurd assumption, truly absurd, particularly including being able to predict the future accurately, that means that cloud of investments, which is different for everybody, suddenly becomes the same. Therefore, P is the same for everybody. That's the point where you have taking the risk-free asset. The P3 to Z line is the same for everybody. So what happens next? Well, the only way investors differ, according to this theory, is by how much risk they're willing to take on. So the one way that he does have you being different is saying you have differing degrees of aversion for risk. And he then draws this diagram where you have three investors shown. They've all got the same cloud now. The cloud's identical for everybody. But this investor here is highly risk averse. So that person puts most of their money in bonds and a bit in the share market. Maybe lends money out to other investors. That person's a thrill seeker, takes a leveraged position in the market, gets high volatility, but gets rewarded by higher return, according to the theory. And here's your risk-neutral individual. Now, they're all buy theta. So what happens? If they all buy theta, then the price of the assets that make up that particular portfolio will rise. The price of those that aren't there will fall. And hey, mefto presto, the cloud gets redistributed. By rising price, you drop the return. By falling price, you increase the return. So ultimately, a whole spectrum, not just a single investment, but a whole range of portfolios become efficient. And there's your capital market line. Have you seen that derivation before? Anybody? Okay. Except people who've done my course. Okay. That's how it came about. Again, that's why I want you to see the originals. It always seems more reasonable when you don't see how it was done. That's a bit like what I'm doing effectively is taking you behind magic tricks. You know, magic is all based on optical illusion and confusion and so on. So magic looks great when you don't know how it's done. It's really great when you see how it is done too, if you see a good magician showing how they fool you. But I'm taking it behind the magician and showing you they actually fooled you with this stuff. And unfortunately, they fooled themselves as well, and they fooled regulators, and all this stuff I think played a major role in why we had a financial crisis of the scale we're having now. So the next part I could go through with my voice being as bad as it is, I'm not going to go through it now. What I explain in the next few slides is how they then get the correlation between a combination of assets and a single asset. So if I didn't have a lousy voice, I'd go through this step by step. But it's basically saying you can work out the return on a single investment by imagining you take that single investment out of a portfolio, then you pivot a portfolio consisting only of that single investment. You'll then get a point of tangency between the market return line and the particular return on that investment, depending on how much its movements are correlated with the market overall. And what you then finally get, after the exercise is shown in those few slides which I'm jumping over, is this expression, which is your standard capital market line expression, where you say the return on a share is the riskless return plus the beta, and the beta there is the correlation of the individual asset with the portfolio divided by the volatility of the individual asset, divided by the portfolio of the market overall, multiplied by the portfolio return minus the risk-free rate. That's how the beta calculation is, that combination of numbers there. And according to the theory, all of your return should be correlated with that beta and nothing else. So that's the clever part of the theory in some ways. And so it said you can diversify against individual risk, you can't diversify against systemic risk, so therefore the return you get is supposed to depend on how responsive you are to the trade cycle. And here's Sharpe's statement of that. Assets which are unaffected by changes in economic conditions give you the pure rate of interest. The higher the correlation with the trade cycle, the more volatile, then the higher return is going to be. Now, that was extended by Modigliani and Miller to say that the amount of debt you got into didn't matter. What a great idea that was. And out of that, you get the efficient markets hypothesis, which tells you don't worry about trying to time the market, don't pull in and out of the market, just simply take a portfolio across time, across a slice in time of all your assets and minimise your risk. And it's an argument that investors focus upon the fundamentals, which are expected return, risk and correlation. So long as you can defend the assumptions made, which of course are indefensible, a common pure rate of interest, homogeneity of expectations, but worst of all, knowing what the future is. Now, Sharpe himself, at a later stage, admitted there were some problems with the theory. And again, this is what you won't find in the textbooks. This is a paper written in 1970. Have a read. I'll give my voice a break. So he's admitting reality, that people do have different expectations. What happens if you take him into account? Notice that, taken into account is disastrous in terms of the theory. And this is the disaster. There is no capital market line. There's some curvy structure instead, maybe. There's no single optimal set of assets to invest in. There's no security market line. Quote unquote, the theory is in a shambles. That's by the author of the theory. It's a pretty damning indictment of what happens when you try to make this theory more realistic. Now, despite those qualms, that theory took over finance for 40 years. I spent 20 years of my life arguing against it and getting derided by some of my colleagues for doing so. Others cheered me on from behind. Now, when you look at the evidence of the theory, initially there are some ways in which you can say it's confirmed by the early data, because the essential idea is that the price of shares should accurately reflect future earnings, and those earnings should rise over time. So you should see some rising volatility in share prices, because share prices include capitalised dividends. And you should find that shares with a higher return are more highly correlated with the trade cycle. Now, and you should also find that investors are simply doing a risk-return trade-off when they choose the securities they invest in and how much they have of leverage. And that's what you seem to find with the earlier research. And this was one of the other papers I've got in the readings, is the paper by Eugene Fanner, when he really went gung-ho championing this thesis as a young PhD student and helped roll most of the old professors in the process. I think those results are a fluke, and I'll show you why. If you take a look at the trend over time, what you find is, yes, there's rising prices over time. This is going back with the Dow Jones, going back to 1914 or 1920, and forward to about 2000. You can see the spikes in volatility turning up there. Now, let's just go and take a look at that in a log term. And what you'll find is that for a while, around when the CAPM paper was published, things look fairly stable and growing. And according to a theory I'll go through later, it's a period of financial tranquility. Debt levels are low, aversion to debt is high because of a past crisis, and therefore there's a lot of stability with low debt-to-equity ratios. All the stuff the theory said doesn't matter actually ended up being fairly important here. And you had steady growth, high employment, low inflation, all the good things you'd like to have, and a steady rate of advance in the stock market until a certain point in time. Now, in July 1949, the Dow Jones is 175 points. A little bit below where it is right now. About 16 years later, it was about to crack 1,000 points. So it had grown quite substantially over 16 to 17 years, about 460% increase in that period. And that kept on going for another 2 years after Sharp published his paper. Then prices went stagnant, and then there was a crash. So if you look at the period across the whole way, you find it was treading water from 65 to 82. And then, with zero appreciation over seven years, with that alone for inflation, of course, it then cracked through 1,000, and then off it goes. First of all into a bust, and then after some years of stagnation, back into another boom again. So here's the chart looking over a longer period of time. I'll update this later and put it on the website with a going through to 2010. I've got it to 1999 here. There's the Dow Jones. Notice the downturn of the Great Depression. Gigantic in log terms. And if you take a look at when Sharpe's paper was published, it was published while that trend was applying. And that's a period of stable growth, what Minsky called financial tranquility. Steady growth, no particular disturbances. And if you plot it, look, it's actually got a steeper slope than the overall average. It's rising faster than the long-term trend. Now, Sharpe's paper was published then. Not bad time to be publishing something extrapolating forward a past trend. And then the crash of 1973 occurred, and market fell 45% in 23 months. And this, to me, 1973 was the beginning of the period of economic uncertainty and instability that's been basically all of your lives. So it peaked at 1052, it fell to 578 by the end of 1974. And then in 1982, after a number of years of stagnation, the bubble took off again. And then 2000, it reached a peak. And if you look at where it got to back in 1998, and I've got to extend this chart, I've been using this chart for quite some time, it's one of the oldest in my collection, I better modernise it. In 1998, it was 21 years ahead of its trend. So you could expect it back in 1998, you could have seen at least two decades of stagnant stock prices simply return to the long-term trend. So when you look along past that initial part of data that Sharpe worked on, the CAPM doesn't look so fantastic. And rather than being a nice deep explanation that we built on and built on, most of the papers written after Sharpe are trying to say why, despite anomalies, the model still works. But the anomalies kept on mounting. And no wonder. If these were the conditions to avoid anomalies, it's no wonder you got them. Investors had to maximise expected utility. They had to be having that risk-return trade-off that I showed you don't have when it's a one-off gamble. Think about stock market investing. If you make an investment and you get it wrong, can you do it again? It's a one-off choice, isn't it? It's not the sort of thing you could provide objective probability to. Therefore, you shouldn't be using expected returns, as Sharpe argued. Now, at the systemic level, the market has to follow a random walk with drift, and the only determinant of stock prices has to be the riskless rate of return and the stock's beta. Now, I've shown you with those experiments that the individual stuff is wrong. Most individuals don't behave that way, and for very good reason. It's very rational not to behave the way economists have called rational. And that's what gave us behavioural finance. But that is, again, the reason I don't teach a conventional course in behavioural finance is I think that even the behavioural finance economists haven't read the original references well enough. And when you take a look at it, it's no wonder people don't behave the way that economists call rational. The mistake was to take it seriously in the first place. So this whole thing about anomalies, again, another reason why I won't take you through a conventional course. One way that people cope with the anomalies is to say, well, people are risk averse. That explains why they don't do what the theory says they should. But it's actually easy to show that risk aversion can't explain why people make those choices that are inconsistent with the theory. So I'll give you another choices now. Imagine choosing between $1,000 for sure or exactly the same one here. And I've shown you the rational person chooses B, which of course you don't. Sensible person chooses A. So you could say that's risk aversion. That was minimising losses with an explanation somebody else gave as well. So you actively dislike risk. So the reason you choose it is not because of the difference between uncertainty and risk, which is, as we know, the real reason. Economists say it's because you're risk averse. But it's easy to show, using von Neumann's stuff about numerical utility, it's easy to show risk preference reversal. So somebody who would be described by this particular experiment as being risk averse can be shown, using exactly the same information, to be risk seeking. So this is fairly complicated, but I'll take you through step by step. So let's say you've got two alternatives, A, do nothing, and B, a gamble, where you've got a 50% chance of winning 150 and a 50% chance of losing 100. It's one of the examples I gave you. Another two alternatives, A, lose $100 for sure, B, a gamble with a 50% chance of winning 50 and a 50% chance of losing 200. Can anybody spot the difference between the two? There's a pattern to those two choices. Anybody see it? I didn't see it in a little moment. Coke bottle here. $100 difference I've simply subtracted $100 between the two. Now, the point of the theory is that your choices are linear in money. So changing every last one by the same amount should be the same as subtracting $100 on both sides of an equal sign. You should still get the same result, or inequality. So take a look at those two. Which would you do in the case of A? You choose A or B? Who choose A? Who choose B? Yep, okay. What you tend to find is that most people do something like choose A and choose B. A in the first place, B in the second. Now, if you're risk averse, you choose A. If you're risk seeking, you choose B. But most people choose both.
So what does that leave me? I chose B then A.
Pardon?
So what does that leave me? I chose B then A.
Oh my God, you're totally off the planet. So most people look like three. Irrational as regards risk. So not only is the theory saying you're irrational when it comes to your choices, you're irrational about your risk aversion as well. Pretty silly. You avoid risk in one case, you seek it in another. Now, it didn't make sense in either neoclassical or von Neumann terms. And I'll show you why. With that first example I gave you, you got nothing for A. So your utility for A was the utility of zero. And this shows you utility of zero had to be greater than utility of 50% chance of 150 and a 50% chance of losing $100. Now, what the axioms show you can do is take those probabilities outside the utility expression. So I can take the 0.5 and take it outside the U and ditto for the other half there. So I can rearrange that and say the utility, one times the utility of zero is greater than 0.5 times the utility of 150 plus 0.5 times the utility of minus 100. And then that's just we choose A over B in problem one. If you choose B over A in problem two, the usual arrangement, that means you're saying the utility of minus 100 is less than the utility of all those. So I simply rearrange it again and say the utility of minus 100 is less than 0.5 times the utility of 50 plus 0.5 times the utility of minus 200. If I then add $100 to each of those, I get a contradiction. Now, that might seem like cheating because I'm adding numbers to it. It doesn't look right. But it's possible to make another one where I show it with a much more direct example. Let's see if I can get it down to here. And I'm going faster because of my voice. So here's another couple of examples. A, you lose $45 for sure. Think these one through as well and see which one you prefer. $45 lost for sure, or B, 50% chance of losing 100 and 50% chance of losing nothing. A or B. So which would you prefer? Who chooses A? Who chooses B? Okay, a bit of a split. Another problem. 10% chance of losing 45 and a 90% chance of nothing versus a 5% chance of losing 100 and a 95% chance of losing nothing. So in one case you got a 1 in 10 chance of losing 45 or a 1 in 20 chance of losing 100. Which do you choose, A or B? Who chooses A? Who chooses B? Okay. A is rational in both cases. Because when you work it out with A, you lose $45 in the first case and $4.50 in the second. With B, you lose 50 and $5 in the second. So in both cases, A is rational. Now the usual story again, people choose B in the first one and A in the second. Okay? So the class, generally speaking, did what the normal person does. Now that gives you a reversal of expected utility. So I'll take you through it step by step. You choose 3B, which is that is the usual situation. That implies losing $45 has less utility than 50% chance of losing 100 and a 50% chance of losing 0. So you do the rearranging and you get this particular expression here. We choose 4A, again the usual situation. Then that same utility of A 10% chance of minus 45 and a 90% chance of zero is greater than the utility of a 5% chance of minus 100 and a 95% chance of zero. So I then take those percentages outside the whole expression, and now what I'm going to do is subtract 90% of the utility of zero from both sides, a linear operation, and what I get is this expression here, and multiply both sides by 10 so I make them comparable to the previous situation, $10. So I'm getting, having just said, if 10% of the utility of that is worth that much, then 100% of the utility of that is worth 10 times as much on the other side. I'm just multiplying the probabilities there, not the amounts of money. Take a look at what I've got. What I've got in the first case is 1 times the utility of minus 45 is less than the utility of that sum, and 1 times the utility of 45 is greater than the utility of that sum. So I get a reversal of the ranking, okay, out of the behaviour of ordinary people. So you can't use risk aversion as a way of explaining why people don't make those choices. So it's not a contradiction, however, as you know from what I've shown you earlier, because you shouldn't be using subjective probability here. But giving you a one-off choice, you are using subjective probability, and therefore you make the sensible choices you did. But if I gave you 100 repeats of those, I lose $45 for sure, or a 50-50 chance, which would you choose? Would anybody choose B? You're going to lose more money. You enjoy losing money? It's okay. Game of cards later. Or six, choose between these two. 10% chance of losing 45, or a 5% chance of losing 100. Again, you'd be foolish to choose B. You'll lose more money if you play it often enough. That's why casinos win. Casinos really are exploiting the difference between your subjective feelings and the objective outcome. And if you stay there long enough, you'll get the objective and they'll win. Okay? So this whole idea was the wrong way to go right throughout to apply to what happens in finance. It suffers from the same core problem that you can't actually work out your complete set of preferences. But it's valid when you have repeated choices. Now, of course, it's not valid when you do that on a one-off basis, and finance is fundamentally a one-off. When you take a particular position, if you get it wrong, you can't go back and try it again. The market's moved on. So what you're doing in finance is a one-off choice. And therefore, if you're going to have a sensible theory of finance, it has to be something which includes uncertainty in it. And that's what I'll cover next week when I hopefully will have a voice back. Thanks for tolerating me so far.
I don't know how this
I put the recording on the website as well, so I'm finished with the function.
Yeah, thank you.
play, okay? Do you want to do the assessment or do you
I'm doing CFM right now.
Oh, and yeah. Actually, management,
yeah. Yeah, I'll cap it next.